war's not won.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Vassals of Kingsgrave for our 99th, asterisk episode. We've actually done a couple more than that in our linear reread through A Song of Ice and Fire. My name is Adam, also known as Drowned Snow on the podcast of Ice and Fire forums. And today I am joined by Zach.
Hey, this is Alias in the forums.
Michael.
Hey, Carl Wadeggi on the forums.
Matt.
Yeah, I'm here.
And Varley?
I'm here.
Murray?
Hi, everyone. It's Mary. No Mary on the forums.
All right. And Justin?
Yeah, Archibald on the forums.
All right. So, Justin, this is your first time on the podcast. Is that correct?
It is indeed.
All right. So before we dig in here, tell us a little bit. How'd you get into Song of Ice and Fire? How'd you find the podcast? That sort of thing.
So I watched Game of Thrones in 2011, and I'm like, oh, hey, books. And I read all the books in 2011. And then by probably 2013, I was scouring the internet for more content and landed on VOK and started listening and joined the forums a year after that. So that was like 2014. So I've been lurking around here for 5 years, just waiting to speak up. It was Quentin that brought me here, though. Got to talk about Quentin.
Well, Quentin lives, as we all know. that's kind of similar. I mean, there are a lot of people that joined in 2011 when the show hit. Kind of same thing for me. Saw the show and then read all the books. So, Well, welcome. Who is your favorite member of the Kingsguard?
You're killing me.
Which Kingsguard? I mean, be specific.
This is a good question. Which Kingsguard?
Just any Kingsguard. Who's your favorite Kingsguard?
Any Kingsguard in history?
Yeah.
I'll go with Boros Blount.
Oh, God, what an awful choice.
What? Hot take.
Well done, Justin.
You name a Kingsguard that's given you more joy than Boros Blount.
Sander more the Lusty? I don't know.
Oh, a bad one.
which book of the series is your favorite?
When I read it, I would have said Dance, but now I think it's Feast. I just love the Riverlands.
Oh, interesting. Okay,
not a lot of those.
Not a lot of like Feast love out there. I liked Feast, but that's good. I like it.
You've lost Matt, I think. I mean, Dolly.
You know when you realize you've got like 5 minutes left in a half an hour long television show and you're like, I just want a little more TV?
Yeah.
That's how I felt when I read Feast and when
that's
I read
what
Dance.
Feast is. That's a great
and now it's 9 years later and
Feast is all about showmanship. It leaves you wanting more. Yeah.
Just give me some more.
I can see that. Okay. All right.
What's your favorite part of Feast? Like what POV?
I like Ario Hota.
Oh my god.
Wow, you're just going against the grain today, I gotta tell you.
No, I like the guys who show up, give us very few POVs, but give us a window into some place or some idea we haven't had before. Some of them are good, some of them aren't.
That sounds like a good segue into Barrist.
In Feast, who's your favorite character whose name can be spelled backwards to spell another character's name?
Matt!
Do I have 20 minutes and a piece of paper to work this out?
Ah, he doesn't know.
I don't.
What is that reference?
I don't know either. To be
Solaris? First seven letters.
Yeah, the Sphinx.
Okay.
Oh,
I thought you meant like two different character POVs.
Yeah so did
same
I.
Same person.
Yeah.
This is why I asked for 20 minutes and a piece of paper.
Mm-hmm. Bran is Rob. No, that doesn't work.
No, it doesn't. I'm sure there's a random character named Bob or something. Work.
Probably. All right. All right. Before we get too far off track here, today we are going to be covering Barristan 2 from Dance with Dragons, which is the Discarded Knight, Quentin's third chapter, which is the Spurned Suitor, the last Tyrion chapter that we've ever had, Tyrion 12 and Dance, and the Forsaken chapter from the Winds of Winter, the spoiler chapters that have been released, kind of slots in right here as well. So why don't we, let's see, this, when do these take place? This is all July. Yeah, okay. So why don't we get started with Barristan, the Discarded Knight, and that is Michael?
Yes, I've got this one. Okay, Sir Barristan watches as his Dar Zalorak holds court for the first time. There is unease in the throne room, with a fight breaking out when a Myrinese noble proclaims Hargaz a hero and dragon slayer. His Dar makes note of Quintin Martell and his companions, and Barristan senses that Quintin will soon be in danger. He briefly wonders whether Quintin was behind the poisoning of the locusts. The Yunkish envoys arrive and throw Grolio's severed head at the king's feet. Barristan recalls that all three of the kings he had served would have had the envoys killed or imprisoned for this insult, but all his Dar can do is stare silently. The sellsword captain, Bloodbeard, claims this as payment for Yurkaz or Yurkaz being trampled to death in Daznak's pit. He releases his Dar's sisters and cousins, but refuses to release the final three hostages until the dragons have been killed. His Dar abruptly ends his court session and retreats to have his council deliberate. Barristan stops Quintin and tells him to leave at once, saying that his Dar has made note of him, but Quintin refuses to leave. Barristan mentions the poisoning of the locusts and says that Quintin will likely be made a scapegoat. Quintin is shocked by this news and denies any responsibility. Barristan tries to convince Quintin to leave once more, but again he refuses, saying he cannot go back without Daenerys or he will be forever remembered as a failure.
All right, so that's a Barristan chapter. It's a perfectly acceptable chapter in a book.
So, yeah, there's not so much to mine here.
So, can I just say that one of the saddest characters in all these books is Grolio? He just, like, gets sent over by Illyrio. Like, his ships get demolished to make siege engines. Then he's made admiral of, like, a no sea until Zaro Duck Sauce comes. And then his head gets chopped off out of all the hostages. Just, all he wanted to do was get home to see his family.
I honestly forgot he had been killed.
I feel like he had a decent life at least, though. Like, there's a lot of people in this story that just get killed off before they can do anything of value. There's that, at least.
So Stefan Sarse has written an essay called The Word is Grolio, and basically, because in the next chapter, the password is Grolio to start the coup. And basically, he chose this word, Skahaz chose it, to play on Barristan, because Barristan is like Grolio in that he is a noble man in a foreign land who just wants to go home. So yeah, the essay talks about how Skahaz is sort of playing Barristan. And we also find out that Skahaz is one of the Brazen Beasts in this chapter.
Yeah. So how does he keep the beast loyalty?
The fact that the new guy's a dick probably doesn't help to switch over their loyalties. And it mentions that the Brazen Beasts are made up of freedmen and shavepates like Skahaz. So they're of a different political class than the Loraks.
Right. They're more aligned toward Daenerys, and he's playing that card, I think, Skahaz is.
Yeah.
So here's a fun fact. If you look at all of the horrible Myrinese names, whether there is a Zo or a Mo in the middle tells you a bit about their class. So the Zos are the higher up ones, and the Mos tend to be, I don't know what you call it. There's not a middle class in this society, but they're just a bit lower.
I knew,
such a Mo. Look what he's wearing. I mean, come on. Yeah.
Like, I knew Varley was a Zo. Mo. Varley was always a Mo.
So where does it say that? That's reflected in the class. I just thought it was like Iz or Ibn or like, you know, son of kind of... name.
You just have to infer it. So, like, Yurkaz Zoyurkaz, which was the commander of the Yunkai, Hizdar Zolorak, Skahaz Mo Kondak, Reznak Mo Reznak, who's just the Seneschal, Oznek Zopal.
He's my favorite.
what other ones?
Yeah, it's definitely the best name.
Grazdan Zograzdan, that's one of the Astapori that has the pearls on his toka. Yeah. Little detail.
So speaking of Skahaz, and I know we've talked about this like 1,000 times, but is it generally agreed that he is the one who poisoned the locusts that we see talked about here?
Yes, I would say. Well, at least here on this podcast. I don't know about everyone else.
Oh, you think it's Quentin? Yeah.
No, I don't actually think that.
It's like a weird like Fight Club situation where Quentin is a split personality and the other one's causing chaos. We didn't see that. Sorry, spoiler for Fight Club. Put that in the video.
Yeah, we don't do spoiler warnings for like 20-year-old material. Anyway. Yeah. So, yeah, I don't know.
So why does Barristan have a POV? It's an interesting question, right? And we're going to see more of him in TWoW. But obviously there are some things that we might only have gotten to see if we got Barristan, as we'll see in his next chapter. But is it important enough that we had to have him as a new POV?
Like right here? I mean, especially with what, like, because the next chapter is like so connected to this one, you kind of wouldn't have really even needed this chapter, but...
This could have been in Quentin's chapter.
Except Quentin's dead.
Right.
Quentin dies.
I do like getting Barristan's inner monologue, and I mean, I like Barristan, so I'm not going to complain that so far his chapter's not really...
Yeah, it opens... Oh, sorry, Mariko.
I agree. I like Barristan, and I like how he thinks and how different it is from Danny's point of view on the whole political situation. And I think he really brings something to the way we see the Marine situation.
And I think the only other likely candidate for like a POV inside Marine would be Missandei, which like leads everyone to believe that Missandei will betray Daenerys, so we can't see what's in her heart.
Well, I mean, she's like 10 years old too, so like that's not a great POV sometimes, as we've seen.
Oh, what? Arya, Bran? What are we talking about here?
Bran is more what I was
Bran.
Thinking.
No,
no, but sometimes, like, you know, his inner thoughts aren't going to be all that enlightening. Like, you know, like I said, the different perspective with Barristan here is nice, and we get. Plus we get the bits of backstory and stuff, kind of.
I think it's good. I think it's worth it.
Plus, Summer Hall. The most important thing is Summer Hall.
Do we ever get that?
We'll get to Summer Hall someday.
Yeah.
But I do like him as someone who has served all these different kings. I like how that kind of informs his perspective and queen.
That's actually one of my favorite parts of this chapter, is hearing that Prince of Dragonfly story at the end. And that, you know, his original nickname was just kind of Duncan just heading off anyone making fun of him at the pass and just like giving him this great nickname that he hadn't earned, but he eventually grew into.
Yeah, like I was going to say, I totally forgot, because like Barristan the Bold is something you know, they talk about all of his battles and, you know, he's the guy that would charge in there and you think like, oh yeah, man, he earned this name like on the battlefield. I always forget we get to this chapter and it was like, oh, like, he was just this like kind of sad little kid that they were like, you know, he was picking him up. He was like, Barristan, look, this bold boy, you know, like, which is just great. And it became aspirational. So
it's a great bit of PR. I always hoped that George had a lot of Barristan coming up. And so this was like we're getting his introduction. But as the years have gone on, I think that perhaps he never had as much of Barristan written as I was hoping.
Well, if you've ever listened to like live interviews with him, he has like a lot. Like Barristan the Bold was like the first turtle story he ever wrote, because it was a turtle that escaped and like hid underneath his refrigerator and then came out alive like 3 weeks later. So like that's what started. He started like writing stories about Barristan the Bold turtle. So there's lots in his brain, I'm sure. But
didn't know that. Interesting.
Yeah, most of his characters come from his turtles.
Yeah, no, I just didn't know.
That is a lot of turtles.
One of the first ones. Now, why were none of them ninjas? Just curious.
They weren't exposed to the ooze, dummy. They couldn't be ninjas.
This was before their time, I suppose. All right. Anything else on this Barristan chapter?
I would say so Barristan describes Drinkwater, one of Quentin's companions, as false coin here. And he mentions he's seen other men like that. Who do you think he's referring to there, if anyone in particular?
Renly, to an extent.
You think? I thought Renly was, like, legit.
Well, the blacksmith describes him as copper. Pretty and nice to look at, but not worth much in the end of the day. So it's the similar situation. I don't know if Barristan had that particular view, to an extent, maybe.
I was wondering if he was talking about, like, Brandon Stark.
Yeah, you trying to bring up Brandon? That's where I thought you were going.
Maybe.
He probably has a grudge against Brandon as well, so yes.
What about, like, Littlefinger?
What about him?
Well, false coin.
I don't know if it's quite the same thing. It's hard to parse exactly what that means. I think he's kind of saying that they look to be more than they are, whereas Littlefinger is kind of the opposite.
He's a little impressive to look at.
Like, yeah. I think Barristan can only judge people on their martial standards, right? Like, Littlefinger is not fighting in the list or, like, you know, jousting or whatever. He's too political. I think Barristan's more like, as far as knights go, like, this guy's all talk.
He's looking at, like, the substance of a man is what you're saying. Like, it's like, you know, versus, like, you know, I don't know how much he really even gives a shit about Littlefinger, really, because it's kind of not his realm.
Yeah,
he doesn't like him.
I thought it was interesting that in the next chapter, Jairus is the one trying to keep Quentin from doing what he's about to do, and he actually has, like, sound arguments, and he's like, if Barristan is telling us that we should go home, I think we should do that. And I thought it was interesting given Barristan's judgment of him.
Also, I mean, it's really easy to see what Quentin's about to do to be extremely stupid.
Yes, clearly, but still, like, I'm talking about the next chapter, so maybe we can keep part of this discussion for there. But what I mean is, if I follow Barristan's judgment correctly, he's saying he's all talk and he. He's like all bravery, but no thinking. And you would expect this knight he describes to be like, oh yeah, let's go. Let's do something very brave and go home with a dragon. And he doesn't.
Yeah, it is interesting that he doesn't give it to Archibald, the other guy who's with him. But maybe it is just as Vali says to point out how much of a bad idea this is that even Drinkwater is telling this.
I just want to say one thing where I think quietly Barristan is one of the sickest burns in this chapter with the she wants fire and Dorne sent him mud.
Brutal line. Stuff.
Yeah, hot. I like that
hot,
comparison.
Hot fire.
But it's like the comparison is harsh, but Barristan himself is thinking that you can do much more like useful things with mud than with fire. To be entirely fair, I read this in Bina's notes, but I thought she was really right on this, that like Barristan talks about how Doran kept his plan way too secret to ever work, because when you're planning to be in an alliance with someone and you're working like the other person knows that and they don't, well, it can't work, because like Quentin arrives and Daenerys is like, well, I didn't know, and so I didn't plan around this, so it can't work. And Barristan was completely right on that, I think.
Yeah, Doran's plans are not I don't know. It's a tough situation, but he lets no one in. He doesn't even let his co-conspirators in on the conspiracy, and that kind of makes it hard.
I liked all the alliterations that Quentin was able to make out of his name. Quentin the Coward, Quentin the Cautious, Quentin the Quail. It's like, that's good. You know, it's clever writing.
Quentin,
George.
Quentin, it rhymes with something.
Simpleton. Nothing. That's a hard name.
Yeah, okay. Speaking of Quentin, we go forward one chapter to Quentin 3, The Spurned Suitor, which is in the book. It's the very next chapter. These happen basically right at the same time. And I believe, Justin, you have that?
Yeah, here we go. In his penultimate POV chapter, our prince, Quentin Martell, a.k.a. Dornest Ned, turns his bad ideas up to 11 by getting drinks with an angry ex in an architecturally improbable wine cellar to hatch up an ingenious plan. Our chapter opens with what's left of Quentin's entourage, encouraging him to take the old man's advice and get the F out of Dodge. Quentin declines, preferring to double down on conning a group of seasoned killers whom he's already betrayed once. There's a meeting to plan a meeting, a lovingly described stroll through the shittier portions of Marine. We arrive at the Purple Lotus, a hovel attached to a hovel, attached to another hovel, which is bigger on the inside. Downstairs with the wine sit the aforementioned season's killers who unaccountably failed to kill him on sight. A meeting ensues where, even more unaccountably, a frog with no money, no army, no queen, a bad record vis-a-vis honesty, and a retinue of two convinces a suspicious Pentashi, through chutzpah alone, that he can provide a wealthy free city thousands of miles away in payment for stealing two dragons that nobody knows what the fuck to do with in the first place. In a story about people finding themselves completely out of their depth and then swimming deeper, it may be the most impressive swindle of all. And that's our chapter.
Ooh, well, that's like the cover jacket, if this were a book about Quentin. Yeah, good work. Nice summary there. So, Quentin's plan, A plus, A minus, B? What do we think?
F?
I mean, there was a chance that it could have worked. Like, what? He just needed to look up and see that Rigel is right up above him and about to breathe fire. But it's pretty stupid. But it's
so. What about the basis of this plan? Just like going back to the well and being like, "Hey, I betrayed you, but I need you to help me." I mean, that's some brass, right?
Yeah, he's got balls.
I didn't think that, you know, that shouldn't have worked, but then, you know, crazy dragons, and it's like, you son of a bitch, I'm in. Yeah, I don't know. He can still be alive. It could happen.
I mean, I think it stands in stark contrast to the next chapter we're going to talk about, right? Like, here you have someone with nothing to bargain with, bargaining pretty heavily, and pulling off the bargain. You don't have a city to give.
So that's an interesting question, right? So why does the Tattered Prince go along with the plan? Why does he decide that it's worth it to do this now?
Because he's always wanted Pentos in the back of his mind.
All right, but why does he think Quentin can deliver that to him? Is it just
if you're riding a dragon?
Well, a dragon.
Everything's possible. But again, both of these people are sort of, they've got these crazy schemes that they want to achieve. And so they're like feeding into each other's, not vanity, but aspirations. You know, if two people have crazy plans, they're bound to both work.
I think that's it, right? Because up to this point, I think he's being very shrewd, right? And correctly calling Quentin out for not being a reliable person, you know, all the times he's turned his cloak and also not really having a lot to offer. But I think, like you say, Michael, because he's so kind of obsessed with this idea of Pentos, he's compromising some of that logic for the sake of that.
Yeah, and he's been, you know, it's partially because, you know, he's just kind of waiting for an opportunity to kind of go over to Daenerys and join her side and whatnot.
Yeah, he's not really losing a lot if it fails, right? There's not a lot to lose here.
Just take another contract.
Yeah. So it's a pretty safe gamble by him. So for Quentin, though, he's basically like a walking sunk cost fallacy, right? He mentions here He mentions here that the reason he has to keep going is because, of course, the people who have died along the way, and that's really his only justification for doing it, which is not a good reason to do things, but he will.
Yeah, sunk cost fallacy, I love it.
Yeah, it's more of him just, like, outright, like, breaking down, you know, the concept of the hero's journey and, like, trying to make it all mean something. And it's just like, nah,
son. Yeah, that's the thing I like about Quentin is he's not, it's not fully developed, but he's this kind of deconstruction of that, right? Where he is this person who imagines himself going on this adventure and being a hero and doing all these things. But everything at every turn goes wrong. He doesn't get any of those markers of the monomyth that you're talking about. None of that happens to him. Just it goes off the rails and it ends badly. And that's why I like that he's actually dead, I think. I think I prefer that to him being living still.
I do too.
He really can't go back. Like he would just, everyone would shit on him. It actually reminds me of all the way back to the prologue in A Game of Thrones with the Royce guy in the Night Watch. Like he really couldn't go back either. He had to go investigate it.
I hadn't thought of that, but indeed I felt really like sad for Quentin because he's right, like his sister and the sand snakes, everyone would be just teasing him about his failure, and that's basically bullying, right? And I felt sad because he can't go back, but like he should have still.
I mean, I think I wrestle with him not being able to go back, right? Like, this is, lots of the characters in the books can't go back in a real sense, right? Like, yeah. Arya can't go back. There's nothing to go back to. Quentin goes back. He's going to get made fun of, right? Like, there's a very different, there's a difference in kind between his inability to go. I mean, he believes he can't go back.
Can't go forward, but yeah, it's you like know? A, it's no, sort of yeah, like the rich kid can't go home sort of thing. You're like, oh, boo hoo, you know?
Yeah, of course. But like, I do feel like it's a real, very real thing for his character that, like, you just have to see the way Aryan thinks about him in her chapters. It's like she has very little respect for him. And, like, of course, between dying horribly by dragon fire and going home and, like, suffer a few, people mocking you, it's not the same thing. But I do understand why it weighs so heavily on him, the idea to go back without Daenerys or anything.
Yeah, I think I'm sympathetic and I understand how severe that social pressure is, right?
Yeah.
It's a really strong thing that I understand why he feels that way. And it obviously, if you really got down to it, you would think, yeah, just get over it, dude, go home. But I get it. I get why that's the thing that he finds so hard to do.
Well, in his mind here, too, I think that if he attempts to, you know, in his mind, he's like, well, I'll try to get this dragon. And if it doesn't work out, then I can be like, well, I tried everything. You know, he isn't necessarily thinking like, well, if it doesn't work out, we're all dead. Because, like, he's got to...
He probably should have.
He's got to do something big enough that at the end of the day, he can go, you know, look, you know, when he comes home, he can say, look, Dad, you know, what more could I have done, right? She said no. Dragon wouldn't let me ride it. I'm back, you know. Although I don't know if he'd even be able to make it home unless he does this. Because as
maybe
we said
if
before,
he took
like
the demon road, but yeah, no ships.
Trying to contact the Tattered Prince. Like, what do you think he would be like? Oh yeah, we'll double the gold and I'll take you home. Like, do you think that would even be an option? Like, I don't think so.
I don't think so either.
You'd kill him somewhere along the way. So
yeah, they looked pretty eager to kill Quentin and his companions in that room. Yeah. Like he says, I'll let you explain it, but afterwards, I'm very likely gonna have at you.
So do you not think that Barristan, like because he suggests like take a ship to Valentis, that there's bound to be some, and he offers to give them the money for the trip. So would that not have worked?
Oh, well, actually, technically, you are right. The port is now open.
Yeah.
But in my mind, I'm imagining Victorian's fleet, which is closing
up. Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah, of course. So I'm thinking, like, no one's really getting out of there anyway. So, yeah.
Yeah.
An interesting hypothetical is just the middle ground. If he just stayed there and didn't try and do anything, like, he obviously doesn't know
pledge that... to serve Danny sort of thing.
Yeah, well, he doesn't know that Barristan's about to do a coup the next day, but that'd be interesting. He'd be in a really good position if he just sat down and didn't do anything.
Yeah. Another thing, Barristan maybe... I mean, Barristan doesn't know this guy well enough to confide in him, but he certainly could have used him as an ally, I guess. Maybe that would have changed things.
I think that would have been a hard road for him to take. He's not there for service, I think, as you guys have rightly pointed out. He's there for glory, for something great, to be a king or to have a dragon, not to hang out. But I think it would have been more interesting for his character if he had stuck around.
If he views it as like he can bide time, maybe he'll win her over eventually or something. Or, hey, maybe this king just, dies. I don't know. I just feel like maybe he needed a little more time before deciding to go after the dragons, but he is kind of, like I said, the move of going back to the person that he welched on and being like, hey, I want to sign a new contract. I mean, the got some balls, so I guess it fits.
One interesting thing I noted in this chapter is that contrary to kind of what Drink says post the burninating, Quentin doesn't seem to have any hard feelings towards Danny, and doesn't really give a shit that she laughed at him or whatever. It's something I kind of had forgotten about, as my thoughts were obscured by kind of Drink statements later on. But I just found that interesting, where he's more pragmatic about that situation that I gave him credit for.
Well, Quentin even says...
Well, I think he understands where she's coming from.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which feels good for him, right? Because he's even getting dunked on by Jalabar Joe, apparently. So this is nice to not be dunked on by Danny.
She never laughed. It is interesting.
I guess I don't know if he ever expected it to succeed. It's not his bad plan either.
You think because his dad didn't set him up very well?
I think his dad didn't set him up very well, and I think he knows who he is, right? Like, he knows what people think of him. Guys who know what people think of him don't sail across the world and successfully convince the Dragon Queen to marry them.
Hmm.
They do what their dad asked them to do, and he gave it the old college try, but I don't think he ever really expected that she was going to be like, you know what? You're the guy. I think he did what he felt he needed to do, and he's continuing to do it.
Really? Interesting. I do feel that... I think he wanted to believe it. I think that I think anyone would, right? They want to believe that everything will work out in the way that you dreamed. You will be the hero. You will be the person who the Dragon Queen wants to marry.
I don't think he thought as consciously that she wouldn't take him. He didn't like go there thinking, well, I'm gonna try, but I know it's not gonna work. But he probably felt it more than he expressed it.
He had lots of anxiety. He was like, the Dragon Queen sounds fearsome, and how am I gonna convince her to marry me? I think he thinks something like that.
To a certain extent, you always have to psych yourself up for something like that,
Yeah.
You have to make yourself believe it, even if you really don't, to some degree. So,
I really like the whole Hazu thing. It's funny, obviously, but it also kind of shows... Yeah. It's really good, the Hazu thing, where one of his guys is like, they're all Hazu to me, or whatever.
I love that. It's
very meta.
It is meta, but it also kind of shows... it shows that kind of that feeling of alienation that they have in this place, that they don't fit. They're just like in a sea of Hazus. It really adds to the tension of them being here and this feeling that like they don't belong. So I like that.
Quentin just needs to watch some LSU hype videos to get himself psyched up to go face the dragon.
Get hype.
Quentin is not Joe Burrow. They're not even remotely.
On that note, all right. Well, anybody have anything else about the Quentin chapter? All right, moving on. Tyrion 12 from A Dance with Dragons. And Zach, do you have the recap for us?
I do. If you guys were tired of all the awesome chapters we have so far, I got an even better one for you right here. All right. Tyrion signs up for the Second Sons and himself into incredible debt, trading verbal jabs with the company's officers all the while. Afterward, he goes to find Penny, who is upset over abandoning Pretty Pig and Crunch in Yezzan's camp. Tyrion fears she may be sick with the Pale Mare. The two set out to acquire arms and armor and meet Jorah there, who is now looking every inch the mismatched sellsword. Some awkward flirting between Penny and Tyrion ensues as they look for armor that fits. Tyrion chooses a dirk for himself and begins instructing Penny in combat, but she can only think of what she has lost, her brother Groat and her two animals. Tyrion slaps her and tells her that if she wants to dream, she should go back to sleep. He informs her that Crunch and Pretty Pig are likely dead and the Mummer show is over. Penny says they would have been better off staying with Yezzan as prized slaves. Tyrion promises her he will find her a new master once the fighting is done. Jorah comments how they will stand no chance against the queen, her dragons, and Unsullied. Tyrion agrees and promises that the time will come for them all to turn their cloaks. All right. So this is Tyrion's unpublished chapter. There's not really a lot to it, but I think it's interesting to talk about where Tyrion's at. You know, this is the whole arc through Dance, right? Is this very down in the dumps Tyrion, this depressed Tyrion who has lost pretty much everything he's had in life and he's tormenting himself with the things he's done. So the interesting question at this point is, has he recovered from that? Because it almost feels that way at the start of the chapter, right? Where he's talking to the officers of the Second Son. He's trading jabs with them. He kind of sounds like old Tyrion here, right? He sounds like the guy who had the wit, had the control of the situation. But I think we see later in the chapter when he gets angry with Penny and slaps her, that there is this anger, this just darkness that wasn't quite there before. There was, you know, Tyrion was always kind of a dark character, but there's just this deep-seated kind of hatred inside him that I think has not gone away and I don't think will go away. So I think that's the big takeaway I have from this.
Yeah, I think we see him turn a corner in the last Tyrion chapter where we get the cunning, kind of methodical Tyrion back. And I think, you know, if there's any anger, it's just because he's been paired with a character that's so useless. Like, she puts Quentin Martell to shame. And I think that's what's really in driving his anger towards Penny.
I think you can also see it with other characters, what's his name, Kem. They're having a little talk, and all Tyrion can think is this guy is a pawn. I'm going to use him. You know, that's just what he is. And you know, there's no friendliness, no fond thoughts for someone like Bronn or anything. It's just I'm going to use these people to get what I want.
It's also on the eve of battle, so he his fuse is pretty short for things that aren't about how they're going to survive the next couple days. I think.
I do think, like you say, Michael, I think there's just a level of malice and manipulation that was not there before, and I think that does signal to us that he is not the same guy. He has recovered the cunning and the thought process and all of that, but it's the motivations behind it and the way he goes about it and thinks about it is so different now.
I'm not sure I'd call it malice, really, because I don't think he really is cruel, but he's more callous than he was before.
Mm. Yeah, it's more, he's kind of just doesn't think much of these people at this point. Doesn't have that empathy for anyone, really.
Which is not quite the same thing as cruelty. Right. Yeah.
Yeah,
he's more willing to survive by walking on the backs of corpses than I think he was perhaps earlier in the series.
That's literally the only thing I thought about this chapter. Is there
I mean, he does... there is that whole paragraph kind of about ruminating about slavery that is kind of just an interesting
Yeah, but we've got
thematic that already. Talking point.
Like, we got that more significantly with Danny when all the freed men want to go back to being slaves. Like, I felt like that was, I mean, it's fine here, but that was like the significant example of that to me.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. No, it's one. Yeah. It's just one of those harsh choices things, you know. Or the line where it's just like, you always have a choice. It's usually between slavery or death.
I think it's interesting here how someone like Penny, who is not born into that system, still kind of buys into it. Because, I mean, it's kind of the same with small folk and people who are disenfranchised there, right? They just kind of need to find a place for them. It's not literal slavery, but just finding a master of some kind. Like she's he says about her.
Yeah.
We get a Singer Stew reference. That's fun.
There's hammer and nail.
That is like that, but it's more about slavery than the mind, that freedom isn't free, but the greatest weapon is the mind of the slaves themselves.
Yes, very true. So just to speak to what's going to happen in the T-Wow chapter, so obviously the battle for Meereen is coming, but we find out eventually that it's not just Tyrion who will turn his cloak. It will actually be that all of the Second Sons will. I guess the plan all along, I don't know if this is true, by Brown Ben was to go back to Dany the whole time. So
that was not the plan the whole time.
Yeah.
I don't know. Brown Ben is just
finding the winning ship.
It's a triple cross.
Yeah.
He's just waiting for her to finally use some dragons. Like, that's really all he wanted.
Indeed. So yeah, we'll likely see Tyrion back over on that side, and that'll be interesting, of course.
Yeah, I mean, that's how this battle's gonna go, where it's just like everyone's flipping between the Second Sons and then the Wind Blown, and then you got Victarion rolling up. Like, it's just gonna be double crosses all around.
Yeah, I feel like in this kind of historical context, like when we were at this phase in human history and in like a story where things are set up this way, it's best to be the person that can like follow multiple options like that, you know, like I'm sort of betraying someone, but I've also was always kind of laying groundwork on both sides, but not like overtly, I don't know, not like too committed to either side. Then people just can kind of like laugh it off and then you just survive everything. I mean, I think that's sort of what Brown Ben has done his whole life, right?
It kind of shows, we talked about this a little bit in the Quentin chapter, right? It's something Brown Ben understands that Quentin doesn't, because like you said, if Quentin had understood that, he would have just kind of waited for the tides to change, understanding that they do change very quickly. The balance of power shifts on a dime. And if he had known that, then maybe he would have made that different choice, like someone like Brown Ben.
Just chilled out.
Because just the who's in power and who has control of the situation, it changes so fast in this world. So
you just have to make moves that like don't exclude you from being in with the next person.
That's kind of the Varys little finger thing, right? That's how they operate.
But I mean, you even see that in Westeros. Like, look at how many, if there's a civil war or conflict or something, like very few of the lords actually get deposed or their houses get ruined. It's the ones that really like heavily committed to one side or the other did things that really would piss off the other side, and it's like, okay, well, we got to kill them all, versus most of the lords just like, well, following orders, kind of did my thing, held back a little bit, and then they're just always forgiven and everything goes back to normal.
You see it with Brown Ben earlier, where he was trying to buy Tyrion to give to Dany as a gift. Like, he's clearly making sure that bridge isn't completely burnt.
I think the turning sides is sort of similar to what we were saying earlier about sort of the Dornish plot and the not knowing. People don't know about it. I mean, when Dany's gone and there are dragons on the battlefield, there's a possibility that it won't be really clear that Brown Ben has turned his cloak and is going back to Dany, right? It's just going to be a mess no matter what happens. And so I'll be interested to see if it actually resolves itself well for Brown Ben, or if he's just in a battle that he has no control over, even though he seems to know what he's doing generally.
Yeah, I think Tyrion will be the kind of deciding factor in that, most likely.
One random thing. Apparently Arryon Brightflame was with the Second Sons. That seemed weird. What does he contribute to a sellsword company?
Didn't they send him away in the second Dunkin' Egg that he heard? After he was an asshole at Ashford, they sent him away.
Oh, yeah, I know he's over there, and obviously he eventually drinks
Wildfire
and dies. Wildfire. But it was weird.
But he's got fancy armor and probably good steel, and you probably brought men with him.
And he's a Targaryen.
Yeah. Tough hang, though.
A little something.
Tough hang.
I mean, yeah. I'm sure there are men who have way less to offer to a free company, but they still take them just because you need men, right?
I mean, dude, he talks about the guy in the last chapter. He talks about the guy who tried to run away because the food wasn't good, and then he like makes him the cook, and then he was like, he re-upped. And you're like, wait, what?
Yeah, I like that. All right, that's all. Anything else on Tyrion?
All three of these chapters are just like middle chapters leading to another like a more important chapter.
It's funny too because with this, it's the last published chapter in like 9 years. So. Yeah,
that's what I was gonna say. Is the only thing is this is kind of a weird thing. Like this is where we end with Tyrion in like the published works, and it's been 9 years now, and we're like, what's going on?
It's almost like this wasn't the planned ending, and George ran out of book space to put the last few chapters in.
I don't know, really. I think it's always my argument, I know, but if we didn't have those 9 years waiting, I think we would just think differently, and we felt differently when you first read it. Because it's still kind of a striking chapter, you get the old Tyrion back, you've got the last few lines where it's like, yeah, I know, we're on a losing side and I'm going to change that. Ta-ta. And it still works for me. It's just if we had the book 4 years after that and not whenever, we would not have the same opinion of it, I think.
Well, I mean, for Tyrion here, everything seems to be like on the edge of a cliff, ready to go over,
which is not like a bad way to end a book for a character.
If you're doing like episodic content, or it's like the end of a show or the end of a season and a couple months is a new one, like, okay, that's where you leave it and it's coming right behind. And I think he did have some Tyrion material written. I mean, because we've gotten, preview chapters and stuff, obviously. We know he had stuff written for Winds that was not, not put in this book. So, I don't know. I mean, he seemed fairly confident that he would get it out much sooner than now,
Yeah,
so,
that's the thing. Yeah.
If it comes out 2 years after Dance, you're like, oh, whatever. Not that bad. Now we're 9 years later, and it's like, oh.
Oh, indeed.
On a personal note, I find myself much harder on chapters like this now than I was when I read them the first time.
Yeah.
Right? Like,
yeah,
it feels like now we're in the morass. Now we're in the circling our tails, waiting for something to happen. And I didn't mind that so much 9 years ago, but now it's like,
Unlike some of the more like lore-heavy chapters, there's less to pick through and less to like say, hey, I picked up something new in this chapter. Like when we're going through a lot of these kind of procedural chapters, so then they don't feel as interesting on like the fifth read,
Yeah, it's just like when you compare it to just the energy and the writing of the other chapter we have here. It's just like it's such a stark contrast. But
I'd be interested for a little ranking system of like sellswords via like their relative honor, like Golden Company's at the top and the the Brave Companions is at the bottom. I'd be interested to know where the Second Sons are on that spectrum.
Like any Second Son, they're firmly in the middle.
Yeah, I think, yeah.
Yeah, I want a leaderboard. I definitely want a leaderboard.
I need to know all these mercenary companies. Where do they rank? Let's.
Some fantasy novels conveniently like have a character being like, oh, well, they're the third best company. And like, come on, George. Build that world for me. That's all I care about. All right. So, do we want to move on to the Forsaken chapter?
Dun, dun, dun.
So, ooh, they've...
So one, One thing that I noticed that ties these three chapters together, they all involve consorting with cell swords. So Bloodbeard throws the head, they talk to the Tattered Prince, they talk to Brown Ben Plum. This is the cell sword podcast in each of the chapters. Interesting, isn't it?
Oh, it's super interesting.
Cell swords, very interesting.
Good catch.
Dario is in every one of these companies. There's a Dario in every cell sword company, is my theory.
And they're all Dario, actually.
And they're literally Dario. so we have these three chapters here, which are very closely related. Two of them are right next to each other in the book. This last Tyrion chapter, I think, is like six or seven chapters ahead of the other ones. So not too far separated. And then we have the Forsaken Winds of Winter preview chapter, which they're saying is taking place about the same time here. These are all, like mid-July. I don't know exactly how it's the timeline for the linear reread is a little hard with the preview chapters, so we're just sort of doing the best we can based on the work of other people on Reddit, basically. So this could be right about now. I'm good with that. Sounds about right. So let's see. Matt, do you have the recap for us?
Such as it is. So here's my one-sentence recap of this chapter, which is Euron reveals his Kanye West state of mind with his I am a god speech, and he gains his powers by literally drinking the Kool-Aid.
That's actually perfect. Euron is Kanye. It makes sense.
And then I have
The Stranger Walks.
Drunken notes I wrote down after the Baltimore game last night. I don't know. Yeah, I find it shocking just how much of his family he has killed and/or raped, over the course of his life. I think he's over 50% of his immediate family, which is ridiculous.
I think one of the clues that we get in this chapter is that he didn't actually push Balon. His hand was in on his death or whatever. He says something like that, which lends that faceless man theory.
Right, it's the confirmation of that.
Yeah.
So it's the usual stuff, obviously the sighting of Pyat Pree, the Valyrian steel armor. We get, more imagery of the Night King's corpse bride. There's some interesting quotes, if a god has raised him up, then a god must strike him down. His description of the drowned god is also very interesting to me. Damp hair still sucks, as he's misogynistic towards his sister. And then the take me to the waterline laughed because it's remind me of that silly singing bass fish on the wall.
The Big Billy Bass?
Yeah.
Singing the Talking Heads?
Oh my god. Yeah.
Oh my god. That is great.
And those are my notes on the chapter.
Oh, we've somehow reached the big mouth Billy Bass phase of the reread.
Yeah. So I wonder if you can still get those in yard sales. They still show up.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
Who thinks that the end of this chapter represents the culmination of a certain prophecy that we see in House of the Undying?
Ugh. Jesus Christ, what's that?
It is a corpse stood at the prow of a ship, eyes bright in his dead face, gray lips smiling sadly.
So is that damp hair?
It's Aeron, but it in turn represents Euron. Because this comes in one of the triplet prophecies, where it's Mother of Dragons, Bride of Fire. The first one is a silver horse trotted to a darkling stream, which people think is Dany and Drogo. The second one is obviously that. And then the third one is a blue rose grew in a chink of ice and filled the air with sweetness, which everyone obviously assumes is John.
I must say, him being tied to the ship is like, it just kind of like hit me that we may get, you know, kind of a chapter of the battle between the Iron Fleet and then the Red Wine and High Garden Fleet, you know, and get all from the perspective of him just tied to the front of the ship, which
absolutely
all of a sudden like super excited for. Like, that's an awesome way to describe a battle and with like a point of view.
I never thought of that, but that sounds really cool.
Yeah.
I can't picture Aaron smiling sadly about anything. Like, it just doesn't fit him to me.
So do you, you want me to tell you what's going to happen? I have a feeling that in this upcoming battle, there's going to be a magical phenomena occurring. So like krakens are going to start appearing and pulling ships down and stuff. And then I think that the drowned god himself will make an appearance. And he's going to stare right into Aaron's eyes, and then Aaron will grow laughing mad like the guy who goes into Cthulhu's mind.
Do you think Euron's going to show up?
The drowned god, yes. Euron, I think he will.
Well, so I think the idea in this chapter, right, the idea posed by Euron, is that all these gods are false, right? These are all just creations of man, manifestations of some kind of idea that they're trying to put into the world. And I think the drowned god is included in that. So I don't think the drowned god will show up, but maybe some kind of monster.
Something. Well, the thing that man calls the drowned god, which is some deep one monstrosity.
Yeah. Mm. So
that but might what would be the point of that? Like, wouldn't that just turn the entire world upside down if the fucking gods decided to show up and do battle on the seas? Like,
but not if they're real gods, you know? Like, if it's just a giant monster.
Because they've been throwing corpses into the sea and stuff, so it's like this huge sacrifice or offering.
Dead things in the water?
Yeah, to an extent.
I think it's notable when all these gods are mentioned. It doesn't mention the gods we know in the story have some kind of power to them, or at least the forces associated with them do. So the old gods, Rolor, and maybe even these deep one things. Like the things that actually exist aren't included in being speared upon the Iron Throne. So I think there is something to those forces being a real thing that could appear in the story and have some kind of influence. I don't know how much with these ones because they haven't really been set up to the same degree. But it would be cool.
Well, for the old gods, there's no like dogma or priesthood really to like represent. You know, there's weirwood trees really, but
yeah, but it's still religious.
He does have a priest of R'hllor in the hold with all the Septas and Aaron and everyone. Which I found a little shocking, considering like what we've seen of the priests and their abilities to kind of sense danger to their own person.
These are low-level priests. They don't have that.
Power. I found myself wondering about the extent to which Euron understands the power of King's Blood, and whether or not he's actually preaching something different than he believes. Because he talks like the priest's blood has power, but the people who are lashed to the front of his ship are the Folly of Flowers, who's pregnant with his child, and his brother, both of whom have King's Blood in them, as opposed to all the other randos who are attached to other people's ships.
Oh, interesting. You think it's like a fake out?
Well, isn't it?
Like, you're telling everyone King's Blood has power and you're the king, right? It might be easier to say, no, it's the priests. It's the priests. Look over there, please.
Well, isn't it like the ultimate fuck you to the gods that he just like described to Aaron? It's like, not only is he killing his brother, but also his unborn child, like the ultimate kinslaying or something like that.
Maybe. I mean, he could invoke the powers of King's Blood without even understanding that was what he was doing, and then think that he had created this magic when in actual fact he did it unintentionally. in trying to screw the gods.
So guys, shade of the evening, what's going on there? Why does Daenerys like taste like foulness and then Drogo semen and then like something else and Aeron just tastes like disgustingness?
Yeah.
No, it's described as like he tastes like multiple things in there, I thought.
Yeah, but for Aeron, it doesn't.
No, I thought it did. I thought he, man, there were parts of it that I read last night. I thought he said like the taste was ever shifting as it went down. But I don't know. I don't have the text in front of me.
No, yeah, I remember the same thing. Like, the taste goes from sweet
It says it was thick and viscous with a taste that seemed to change with every swallow. Now bitter, now sour, now sweet.
Yeah.
Maybe this is a bad batch of Shade of the Evening. It went off.
I thought it symbolized quality. Their life. Maybe it's a really good batch.
Okay, so Aeron has just had a shitty life, so it doesn't taste good at all.
I think that's what I was thinking too, actually. Yeah, he just has no good memories.
Yeah.
And it's kind of funny if he's like tasting his past, present, and future, and he's like, this tastes like shit.
Iron Islander.
I was just gonna say, I just think it's worth noting. I think this is some of George's best writing, which is why it was so energizing for the fandom at the time we got this chapter. It's just there's just like an energy to it that is really that you can feel that's very palpable, and it's just really obviously good horror writing, which it's, is something that he excels at. The terror of what the situation is with Aeron and just the escalation of that. It's all very strong, and it got me more interested in this part of the story in a way that I wasn't before, which is really, really cool. And just an isolated chapter being able to completely change what you think about some of these characters. Just some of the lines are really good. Like the it's always been night in the belly of the beast, and just the idea of the black wine sea and a lot of the ways it describes the situation that Aeron's in the hall. It's beautiful. I really love it.
When he comes out right at the end and like the sky is red and the castle's on fire, it's just like he's come out into some other dimension almost. It just feels, psychedelic horror.
Yeah, especially with the Valyrian's steel suit and how he's glimmering and looks like some kind of, demon god or something.
It's freaking ridiculous, man. Valyrian steel armor. I mean, so we covered this chapter when it came out. We talked about it on the Euron cast. We've talked about the chapter quite a lot, actually. And it's a really, really good chapter. I don't know if anything will be changed when it's finally published. But, I mean, it is a great chapter.
I like the Night King corpse queen imagery in one of the dreams, because it very much, that's what the impression I get for Euron, is that he has been taken in thrall by the others to do their bidding, essentially, in some aspect.
You think he's in league with the others?
Yeah, in the same way that Saruman was serving Sauron.
But Saruman knowingly, allied himself with Sauron. Like, do you think that's what happened? He talked to the Great Other and was like, hey, we're buddies?
I couldn't say if there's been, like, a telephone conversation, but I just, Oh, something else from this chapter is that there's a little bit more evidence that Euron was a failed apprentice of Bloodraven. So I feel like he has had some exposure to the coming doom. So his flag is a red eye on a black crown with two crows next to it, which admittedly isn't that much.
What kind of eye stuff going on? Like
he's a failed apprentice.
The Red Eye obviously being Blood Ravens. It mentions ages ago that there's bits and pieces that he got really sick when he was a kid, like Bran did. He had that dream where he said, I thought I could fly, but when I woke up, the Maester said that I couldn't. What else?
Well, he has a Red Eye, right? That's the one he keeps patched up.
And is it red?
Is it red, though?
I thought so. Hold on.
All right.
Supposed to be
what
black.
Color is your odd's eye?
It's black.
About to say, I thought it was like a
pure black.
Kind of like a milky
white.
Like it's almost, yeah. Right, yeah, it's almost like, you know, a glazed over.
Damaged, yeah.
Yeah, damaged eye. I mean, but he's got the bright red eye patch, so.
But I mean, to me, all of that also goes with the question of what are those visions and those dreams? Like, what control does Euron have over them? Because it seems like he does kind of show Aaron what he wants him to see, but it's coupled with what Aaron fears. But like, what truth do they have? And like, yeah, who conjures those?
Well, I think Shade of the Evening just gives you prophetic images, whether you like them or not. And then some of it plays on your expectations and your personality, like it did with Daenerys.
So are we 100% convinced the woman with pale fire hands is the corpse bride of the others?
What's that? Who's this? I mean, did I miss something?
Yeah, so it's the queen standing beside Euron at the Iron Throne.
Yeah, yeah, but what connection does she have to the others prior to
this chapter? Yeah, I was kind of wondering that, too.
Just that he knows there... It's just part... It's the myth of the Night King.
Any, I don't, yeah, again, I can't really explain this, but when he says, you know, I say all of Westeros is dying, these are the dark days where the world will break and be made, days of gods and kings and whatever, and it just, like... It just really feels like he has sensed the coming apocalypse and wants to get in on this in some way that helps him. And I just imagine that there is some manipulation coming from the others.
Well, I mean, if he had been both to the far north and to Valyria, then he theoretically could have been exposed. I mean, exposed to both sides of what we understand to be magic in this world. Right. I mean, it seems like he's calling upon water magic, which seems to reside in a couple of places. And it seems like he has this deep tie to Valyria. It wouldn't be surprising to me to find that he was being manipulated by the Great Other, thinking that he was bringing the death of gods because he had been to both of these places and survived both of those challenges.
Yeah, I'm so curious about what went down in Valyria with him, like what he found and what he learned there.
I think he's a liar.
Oh, you think it didn't happen?
Yeah, just because when Roderick has
you don't think
scene...
he went to Valyria?
No, when Roderick has the scene and says, have you? And then Euron just gets really pissed and tells him to shut up. Like, that's coded language for he's lying and overcompensating. But yeah, that's just my take.
Well, I think he's definitely not telling the truth. But I mean, where does he get all these wonderful toys? You know,
he could have gotten it from the warlocks because that's also where he got the dragon horn. That's just one idea.
Maybe.
So while Aaron is kind of tripping balls, he says that Euron showed the world his blood eye now, dark and terrible.
Oh, okay. That's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, the question of whether he went to Valyria is interesting, right? Because no one else has been able to do that in a way that didn't horribly destroy them, like we have the story in Fire and Blood about how badly that goes.
What's her face with the worms or whatever?
Yeah, so...
Which makes me think he is a liar.
Yeah, I think that's a very valid take on that.
Because she had a dragon and he didn't.
It just seems like a place you just can't go. Yeah. So how could he do that?
But where did he get the suit of armor and the horn?
Well, I mean, there are still, like, Valyrian swords and stuff, like, lying around in the world, just part of the previous, like, what existed before, the Doom. And why not? Like,
where did he get a dragon's head?
Well, where did Danny? Well. Did I mean
under Winterfell?
Nope.
It definitely. I'm sure he's plundered crazy places. It definitely could have come from somewhere else. Yeah, I mean,
just not Valyria.
I mean, there's also stuff we don't know, like the map is only so big, right? There's places that people in this world just have never gone and never really even thought to try to go. Yeah. So,
but wouldn't that be more of an accomplishment, like finding a new place than being like, oh yeah, I landed in Valyria?
Oh yeah, totally. I mean, I personally want to know what happened in Valyria. I hope that we do get that. I'd be disappointed if we don't, but you know, I'd also kind of understand if we never get that.
Yeah, the interesting kind of meta-textual question, right, is if it seems to be in this chapter that Euron is being set up to be a significant player in the endgame of the story. So I guess the question is, like, how plausible is it that Euron is one of the major forces at work in the world at this late in the game? Like, he's being set up as one of the primary actors. Does that seem reasonable?
Or yeah, I agree. I think he is. Like, George took care to plant him in the story as in the Clash of Kings, which I think is where a lot of the expansion of the story took place. So I feel like he was always going to be a late game major villain presence.
Yeah, I think that it's a very George move to like set things up three books out, you know.
Yeah. But I mean, shouldn't it be constricting? Like, do we fucking need a new villain?
That's the question, right? Is he continuing to do what George has been accused of, which is continuing to create more threads and not closing threads?
If you think of him as a puppet of the others, which I'm going to keep peddling, he serves more as connective tissue from Daenerys going to south of Westeros and then presumably going north. Yes.
Well, Euron has been like mentioned by people for a while now, since like Theon and like a Game of Thrones to like the Clash of King and stuff. Been mentioned a few times.
Oh yeah, I'm not disputing the fact that he's been set up as a force in the story, but it's just when thinking about what the end game of the story is, right? You know, we have a lot of things at play. We obviously have a lot of conflicts brewing on a kind of human level in Westeros Aegon or Vaegon or what have you, with Daenerys, of course, eventually most likely showing up there and everything like that. But also, of course, the others invading and everything associated with that. So having another thing there, like, it's just kind of hard to parse what that looks like. But there's two books. I think it's possible it can all work.
Maybe.
I see interruptions, right, with
whether it's two or not.
Yeah.
Or seven more books we're gonna
yeah. But I think if you figure out you should write to George.
Yeah. But also, like, the two major battles are about to take out a number of major players, so especially on, like, say, the villain side, if, you know, if most of the Boltons are probably gonna die quite soon.
Yeah, I think we're about to lose a lot of people in this next book. I mean, we see at the end, you know, Kevin's out, whatever's happening with Cersei, and I think stuff's gonna hopefully
Stannis
gonna move
as
quickly.
Well, something with that. Yeah.
Yeah, something's gonna happen with some of the people that have been fairly powerful in this story. I don't know. I mean, like, even like Cersei could die. You never know.
Like, God, I hope so.
Well, I think she will eventually. It's whether or not it's, yeah, I mean,
Stannis soon is what I mean. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right, yeah. Stannis and Cersei are the ones I'm curious if they survive winds or not.
Yeah, I really care more about what's going on in the north, you know?
Right.
Right. I mean, that battle's going to be a lot of fun, I feel.
I like Euron being a wild card. I like wild cards appearing.
Wild card.
Yeah, like the best books, wild cards. Have you read them?
Yeah, we don't like the books, actually.
I like that being a thing that complicates the story. It's just a question of, can George then put it together? That's the question. But I like him being another kind of wild force that's going to disrupt things.
So in Euron's, one of his psychedelic visions, Euron blows a horn to his lips and krakens, dragons, and sphinxes all come and bow and perform for him. So in the last podcast, we were discussing, well, I was suggesting that Euron's going to get a dragon somehow. So I think this is evidence of a sort. And I also think this is naturally evidence that Kraken's going to be showing up in this battle against the Red Wind fleet. But we will see.
So that was adjacent to that. That was another potential theory that I thought could be the white fire woman, which is could be Viserion. The actual dragon, the white dragon.
What?
So, yeah, just a manifestation of that.
No.
As we know,
I hate a white dragon?
No, female.
He's like golden cream or whatever. Is his color?
Yeah, he's like
close golden... enough.
Well, yeah, I guess he could be. Could be kind of a white. Yeah.
I'm excited for Krakens, but I hate the idea of Euron getting a dragon with some stupid horn or whatever.
Yeah, me too.
Or if he has two horns.
It might be a temporary
mentioned in one, and then you'll have two.
It's interesting, though. It means, like, because we kind of think of the dragons are as being on the side of, like, fire magic, if we've got fire and ice. But maybe, like any other kind of magic, that they can be used by both sides, which would be kind of a game changer, I think.
Well, George has always stated that he's not into magic classes. There's a uniformity to all of these to an extent, like there's overlapping bits.
So, yeah, but there's also like the idea that dragons are really specific, specific to Targaryens, specific to like just fire, obviously. So it doesn't mean the idea I had, at least when they were born, is like that they are creatures on the side, maybe of good, even if they also can be quite violent. But that's because they come with Dany, and so you have her perspective of them. It would be really crazy to see Euron with a dragon. That's it. That's just what I think.
Well, isn't it, in Martin's own words, that they're to symbolize nuclear weapons? And he was a Vietnam protester, so I think dragons, in his own opinion, won't be the best thought of.
Okay, yeah. I can see that.
Yeah, I don't think they have a particular side. They just happen to be very useful in defeating what we presume is the real threat of the others.
Yeah.
The dragons will do what dragons do.
Clearly. I've got to go back and listen to the podcast you all did on this chapter a while ago, because that's actually the first. That's the way I discovered VOK. Like, a friend of mine sent me that specific podcast where you talked about the Forsaken chapter. And I was like, ooh, wait, I haven't read that yet. I can't listen to this podcast. But actually, this guy seem interesting. So I might listen to other episodes. And that's how I got into the reread and VOK in general. But I don't think I ever got back and listened to the Forsaken cast.
Yeah. It's hard to believe that was 4 years ago.
It's
Oh my God.
Yeah.
And that was this is the last
before my time.
The last preview we've had, right? So
yes.
Yeah. It's the last one.
Was the Sansa one after?
I don't think so. I think
Sansa was before.
I mean, we've gotten like half the book by now, haven't we?
Right. Well, I mean, he eventually hit a point where he just said he was going to stop releasing preview chapters.
Yeah, I think he said he had the like half written back in 2013. So I think that he probably scrapped half of it and started over.
Yeah, it's funny. This one wasn't even published at all. It was just transcribed. So it's,
yeah, it's
not even a like published one that we could see.
Right. Yeah.
So I guess we're all waiting for the 13th. I guess he's going to makes his annual announcements on 13th about New Year's or something. Some bullshit.
Why
on the 13th? Because why specifically on that day?
I don't know.
Because it's unlucky. It's a ill omen.
Oh, is this like already... a TWA release theory thing?
No, someone brought it up on the last podcast because I was bitching about how he hasn't given us a TWoW update for the new year. And someone was like, oh, he updates on the 13th every year. So I just took him at their word like I do most of the time.
I did not know that.
Background investigation and, you know.
You heard it here first from Varley.
Classic Varley.
Right. So
also, well, Varley, come on, guys.
Just put out conspiracy theories with no evidence backing them up.
Varley yeah. just
I mean that is
red eyes
tomorrow.
10 minutes ago.
So. That'll be before this is published. So this might be published and be completely irrelevant. Yeah.
How disappointing of you, Adam. Like, I mean, you could have been, you could publish that in 2 hours like Bina, but no.
I could put this up today, and I might, but I'm on call at the hospital in like 2 hours.
This was a joke, you know?
No, I know it was. But I prefer to get these things
literally
up like quickly if I can, and just get them done. We done? What else? What else we got? Anybody have anything coming up? I know we're going to be doing a Mandalorian podcast soon, and we've got Harry Potter going on, more rereads. Yes. Harry Potter's back, y'all.
Yeah. With never Bina, we were talking about maybe doing a Anne with an E episode again, because we've been
the Netflix
watching that.
Show?
Yeah. It's really, 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 really awesome. I'm way into it. I've been watching third season was just released, but I've rewatched the whole thing in like a week, and I'm really excited. So we'll see if we do a cast on that.
Yeah. There's so much good stuff.
Witcher.
Good stuff going on right now. Witcher's going to be coming out. We probably won't do anything on that new Dracula that just came out because it's terrible.
Is it?
Yeah, I've heard that.
I watched the first two episodes and they were okay. I was like, okay, what's going on here? And the third episode, I mean, they're like hour and a half.
Adam, you need to understand about Stephen Moffat is he doesn't like things to make sense.
I realize that. But it was like retroactively after seeing the third like portion of that. I was like, oh, those last two were kind of a waste then, I guess. Like it was pretty bad. But
I heard that episode was trash.
If you watch just the first one, you'd probably be okay. You could watch that, and you could just stop and be fine. Reread, we're almost done. We've only got, I think, like another 5 or 6 episodes of the reread before we're like all caught up, and wins will be announced once we finish. So
finish, it will be announced.
We've talked about this before. He's clearly waiting for us to catch up.
Yeah, he's just sitting there ready to press the button on that old computer.
There's a lot of people counting on us here, guys. We gotta finish this fucking
speed through here. So he has made that arbitrary line in the sand with like the World Con this year or whatever.
I know.
Don't believe that shit.
Until the deadline passes, I'm just nope. If it comes and goes and something happens, then great. But yeah. All right. Well, this has been a lot of fun. I look forward to the next episode of the reread, which will be Quentin's life. So we'll be covering the Kingbreaker, Barristan's third chapter. The Dragon Tamer, or lack thereof, Quentin's fourth chapter, and The Queen's Hand, Barristan's fourth chapter. So this is like all happening, you know, kind of one after the other, I think, where we get revealed that Quentin is faking his death for a greater cause later on. All right.
Oh, boo.
So I think Bina's probably hosting that. And that'll probably be out before this one's published.
I just picture Quentin showing up with like an eye patch and a beard, just like this was all my plan the whole time.
I'm his brother Martin.
So you guys take it easy. I'm gonna start chopping this one up. Make sure my recording worked.
Fun time, guys.
Cool. Okay, guys.
See y'all.
Yeah, it was very nice and super nice to I want to say meet you, Justin. Like hear you at least.
Au revoir, Marie.
Yeah, it was good talking to you all again.
Yeah, au revoir, Justin, Matt. You're great. Come back for more of this.
Yeah, definitely.
Thanks. Tighten up.
God damn it. Bye, guys. It was great.
No.
Guys, we're terrible at this. Am I the only girl here?
Bonjour, Marie.
Salut, Matt.
Abby was going to be here.
Yeah, I know, but she dropped out.
It's a very unbalanced cast.
We're just going to refer to you as the girl.
Nope.
I was watching someone do a thing where they were like casting an old like 80s pulpy cartoon and they were like playing into all the shitty tropes of that time. And one of the roles they had was the girl. That was just like the name for the role. And they also had the girl, but bad was another.
Oh, gosh. I told him to be ready for certain questions and then I'm going to ask him different ones. That's how I did that.
Let's make him drink.
What's your favorite season of the Expanse? Just randomly.
What's your favorite city in Essos?
Pentos.
It's a good choice.
I mean, the Doors of Stone. Like, there was like a leaked release date from that, but I don't know if that's real.
Wait, what?
Or not? Yeah. Nothing's been confirmed, so like they're saying potentially August of this year, but
really?
But that's past WorldCon, don't get excited though.
I'm not gonna, but I want
that. How long
gonna
me too. So maybe this is the year. Maybe this is the year we get these books.
Hope springs eternal.
But if not, there's lots of other content. Like not Netflix's Dracula. But other things.
We are, in fact, I think, getting a new Gentleman Bastards this year. So maybe this is the year.
We are.
How long has it been since Wise Man's Fear?
It's been the same, 2011.
Oh, really?
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. It's been a long time.